live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on a regular telephone today and tomorrow because our main studios, New York City, are in the process of being enlarged and improved, and that will take 2 days, and then we'll be back to our regular higher quality sound. Today is going to be a commentary day. We're going to share some commentaries of my own, as well as The Martyrdom of Julian Assange by Chris Hedges from Truthdig, also from Dr. Gary Kohls, that's K-O-H-L-S, he's a wonderful physician, about what we're not being told about vaccines that's there if you choose to read the actual scientific literature. Also, it's not only that the permafrost is melting, that's a problem, that gives us more methane, but according to University of Eastern Finland, new research from the Arctic is thawing permafrost peat moss is going to add a tremendous amount to the atmospheric CO2 burden, far more than what we've ever seen in human history. Also from Reuters, the U.S. farm debt soars to levels seen, well, not since the 1980s farm crisis. So what does that mean for you and I? What does it mean for the farmers? I'll explain. And how to survive the journey ahead from John Whitehead, one of America's leading constitutional attorneys. We also have some audio clips to share with you. And as I like to do, I like to select audio clips that are provocative, that allow us to hear different points of view, whether we can agree or disagree on all or part of it. It stimulates thought because these are issues that are not being discussed in the echo chamber of the mainstream and even alternative medias. And we have two of those today, and one of them is rather interesting. I was going to play it yesterday, and I did my show live yesterday. In fact, Michael G. Haskins, who's our engineer here on WBAI, was in studio live on the holiday, and I was on the road, and we have generally a small audience in that day, so I saved it for today. And it's a reminder, if nothing else, about how people who have so much entitlement, and in this case, white liberals, going to Stanford, University of California, Berkeley. Mind you, now, this is considered a very prestigious university, historically, a lot of political activism, and they are completely disconnected from reality. Every single person interviewed, and there were lots interviewed, they all had the same idea about what it means to be black. So is this really the way that we should be having discussions about race or anything involving race by people who are functionally illiterate, disconnected, and in these artificial bubbles that they live in of wealth and distancing from having your feet on the ground? They're going to be the policymakers of the future? Wow. You won't want to miss this particular point of view. And the other one is, what happens when a relatively small group of individuals captures the social media's pulpit and starts railing against what it is to be a man? In effect, eviscerating, destroying, demonizing, just being a man. How much hate can one group possibly put forth, and what does it mean if they manage to influence policies? And what does that do to young men growing up who don't suffer from, you know, bounding hormones or some form of masculine, you know, pride of excessive dominance? They're just normal human beings. So this is an interesting debate that we need to have in our society. I am opposed, and I have gone on record, I will go on record and plant a flag in the middle of that. I am so opposed to what I personally see identity politics doing to rip the guts out of anything representing spiritual and humanistic values. And unfortunately, most of the people who espouse these views, I don't care that they're atheists. You have a right to be an atheist. I respect your right to be an atheist. but I do not respect your right to think that somehow you're smarter than someone else because for a moment in time you captured the American public's attention by yelling, screaming, demeaning, denouncing, and somehow the louder you announce things with more anger and rage in your voice that we're supposed to take that as serious discussion. It is not. It is the height of infantilism. And for those of us who maintain a more grounded sense of maturity on discussing issues, it's an embarrassment. But just remember, the fact that some people can get the microphone in a given moment and say that cauliflower is racist, in that idiotic mindset, and I'll be addressing that on tomorrow's program, yes, that was actually said, and that we shouldn't plant certain crops because planting certain crops is racist. Yes, the liberal Sherpa actually said that, and I'll be having you listen to her actual words, talk about beyond dumb. And then you think, can she really believe that? Because everything she's saying is actually contradicted. If she knew anything about heirloom seeds and where these products actually originated from to begin with, as if there was never a Mesoamerican, there was never someone growing corn and yams, etc., on the American continent or the South American and North American continents. Wow. We have entered the ages super dumb and proud of it, arrogant and defiant in spite of it. Well, wherever I can, I'm going to put a mirror up there, and I'm going to talk about it, debate it, do a commentary on it, because I believe that if we don't, then we should not have any reason to complain when one day there's a law where you can't say something, you can't speak someplace, you can't hold a view, you can't say my body, my choice, because someone says, oh, no, it's not your body, it's ours, and we, the dumb crowd, want something to happen to that body. But hold on, haven't we been working for decades to bring back some choice in the matters that are intimate and personal to each of us, that are within our domain? There's a big danger when the mob rules. And if we haven't learned that, then shame on us for not taking an honest look at history. Anyhow, that's our show today. As you can see, we're going to take on some issues that are important. But if you've been around for 43, almost 44 years, another 5 months will be 44 years on this WBAI, then you know these are the issues that I address. Always starting with the latest on health and healing. Today, there's this study published in the peer-reviewed journal Critical Reviews in Food Science and Nutrition, and it says that supplements beat sunlight at increasing vitamin D. This was done at Isfahan University of Medical Sciences. And it's a meta-analysis, meaning they studied many different studies and found a greater ability for vitamin D supplementation to increase serum vitamin D levels in comparison to sunlight exposure. Now, how's that possible? Wouldn't it just make sense you go outside and you stay 20 minutes in the sunlight and you're manufacturing about 10,000 units of vitamin D? Three, they're suggesting anywhere from a low of 400 units to a high 5,000 units I use a day of vitamin D. But here's the problem. The problem is that in a lot of places, and let's just talk about in the United States or North America, people are now going to work earlier, coming home later, and they don't get that outside time. Then a lot of people in the sun time lather up with toxic sunscreens. Yeah, they're toxic. They end up in your blood in about an hour. And that doesn't allow vitamin D to be manufactured in your skin. Then you have the problems also that if you have a deeper melanin and a deeper level that the sun has to get to in order to create vitamin D3, that there's a high probability you're going to be deficient, which directly affects your immune system. And then most people don't let at least one half of their body get exposed to sun when they're out in the sun. So we're simply not able to do it on a regular basis. Hence, if you take a vitamin D supplement each day, you're getting your vitamin D. Also, what about a person living in Nebraska, where the weather has been horrific, versus in Texas, Florida, and Southern California, where it's more likely to be sunny? So just something to consider. Now, a lot of people in this audience, a lot of people in America suffer from knee osteoarthritis. Now, according to IBSA Institute of Bio Research in Belgium, chondroitin sulfate, now that's a common nutrient, a natural occurring nutrient, is much better as an anti-inflammatory than drugs for knee osteoarthritis. The key is something that will create a natural lubrication that can turn off inflammation. Chondroitin sulfate does both. Chondroitin is spelled C-H-O-N-D-R-O-I-T-I-N. Chondroitin sulfate, S-U-L-F-A-T-E. For a long time, for probably 40 years, I've been recommending it for people with inflammation of your joints, including your hip, knees, ankles, wrists, shoulders, and it works. I also suggest it with chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine sulfate. Glucosamine and chondroitin together, 1,000 milligrams to 1,500 milligrams a day, makes an enormous difference of turning off pain. So anywhere from 800 to 1,500 milligrams can do the job. And I do not recommend people use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs because they're extremely dangerous. And they kill people. Aspirin kills over 25,000 people a year. And this was published in the Annals of Rheumatic Disease. Then from the University of Regensburg, which is in Germany, comes a study published in Human Wellness, Food Science and Human Wellness. Quote, the Western diet, that's the diet we eat, can impair memory function. So university researchers in Germany investigated the utility of spatial separation, a behavioral process associated with the hippocampus, in the assessment of dietary interventions on behavioral effects, and found that if you're eating a Western diet, that means French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, lots of processed foods like pretzels, potato chips, you're far more likely to end up with problems with your brain and memory. And they've actually been able to isolate which parts of the brain are being affected and how. And specifically, it's the hippocampus, H-I-P-P-O, campus, C-A-M-P-U-S. And that's not the first study to suggest this. I've seen many studies about the relationship of the hippocampal function and diet quality in both humans and animals. And that's one of the reasons I suggest to people, don't feed your cat or dog out of cans. Give them the type of food that if they were in nature and had a perfect diet that they would be eating. And as much enzymes, as much of the raw as you possibly can put into a diet. And it makes all the difference in the world than proper supplementation, meaning the omega-3 and 6 fatty acids. It's very good for cats and dogs. Lots of good quality fiber. And even blending vegetables with brown rice or millet. And millet is a very good protein source for animals and for humans. It's grown originally out of Africa, and it's a little tiny yellow kernel. It's round, and it looks something like what you would see beads on a string. Very easy to eat. Very good if you have digestive problems. And it has a nice nutty aroma to it, and you don't even actually have to cook it. I found that just putting it into a bowl, then putting some hot water in the bowl and stirring it around and then putting a towel over it, you come back and it's softened up enough to be digestible. So it's one of the things that I found allowed dogs and cats. And that's something I knew about. I've done a documentary on naturopathic care and wrote a book on it. But more importantly, I've raised over 3,000 animals that I've rescued and given love and attention to get them back their health, and then try to find them a home for life, a love home for life, or let them back out into the wilds. And I've been doing this for a long time with a lot of different variety of animals, from giraffes to camels to buffaloes and water buffalo and bisons, zebras, and then right down to dogs and cats, even squirrels and rabbits. Remember the day after the hurricane, something I'd never seen before. Right outside the barn door, where all the animals' food is prepared, there was a tiny, two tiny little things. If you didn't look, you would have stepped on them, because the two together probably weighed 1 ounce. There was a baby squirrel and a baby rabbit. Now, they didn't get there by themselves. So the likelihood was that the mother of both was somewhere watching and knew that that was a place that they would get help. Maybe in the storm, their natural habitat was destroyed. Maybe the animal was injured and was hoping that their baby would be rescued. In any case, we rescued them. And it's a whole process of knowing what formula to give them so they don't die. You can't just give them anything. It has to be similar to what their mother's natural milk would be. And then you have to feed them about 10 times a day. And you have to keep them warm. And you have to keep them close to your heart because they also, they're affected by the heart rhythms. Most animals are. And then they were both put in the same enclosure together to protect them from predators. And over the next 4 months, they grew up and till the day came when let them out. What was interesting, they were let out one day apart. And that little squirrel would come out every day until it was ready to be let out. And it'd jump up on your shoulders. And if you had longer hair, it would make a little nest with the hair and wrap all your hair up into like a nest. And then put nuts and seeds in the middle of your head. It was so cute. And it'd jump all over you and come up and give you little kisses. And the rabbit was not as frisky, but just as gentle. And the first creature to be let go was the rabbit, and just put it right outside the barn and just watch it. And sure enough, another big rabbit comes over, I'm assuming it was the mother, and sniffs its nose and licks its face, and then the two go off together. And they went over there in the woods beside the barn ever since. The same thing happened with the squirrel. So indeed, the mothers were there watching every day because we put them out in an enclosure to, so they could get sunlight, which they need. You need sunlight for your immune system. But because of the diet that we give people, give animals, and that I give people, it makes a huge difference in the quality of their life and how long they live. Just suggesting if you have a creature, don't buy just regular store-bought, you know, kibble and some wet food for your dog or cat. That shortens their life along with over-vaccination by probably 50%. I have dogs that live 24 years old, cat lived 26 years old, in good health. So yours too also could live long. From University of Reading in the United Kingdom comes a study about the consumption of dairy foods and red meat and processed meat. And it was a very interesting study because it wouldn't be new to anyone in this audience. But for the larger community, it is. Because it says that when you see over a period of time the role of these processed-friendly foods, meaning people like them and they're given so often, it doesn't mean that the person is getting more nourished. And you can't say just because your diet has improved that that is the reason that a person's living a longer life. It's just like instead of giving the credit, 100% of the credit to vaccines for communicable diseases no longer being here, we really should be thanking the plumbers, the city engineers, the chlorination of water, the improvement of removal of waste disposal, burying bodies outside the city, not putting them in the rivers at one time in the Thames in London, for example, and then people downstream using that river water to drink. We don't look at the many things that cause people to live longer lives, like eliminating child labor that was endemic at one time in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. So you have to look at everything that makes a difference in our lives. Well, according to the University of Athens, chamomile tea is tied to a lower thyroid cancer risk. And consuming it each day you're less likely to have thyroid cancer. That's a big deal. Chamomile has a lot of good things that it does in the body. It's a calming agent, especially if you're having a rough day and maybe your nerves are a little frayed. Having a cup of chamomile with two tea bags and then maybe a half a teaspoon of Manuka honey can be just what you need. And also the people who follow the Mediterranean diet, which, by the way, is virtually the entire native population in Greece, use chamomile, and it's very common there. So chamomile tea and preventing thyroid cancer. Also from the Salk Institute, Herbasante, S-A-N-T-A, that's a medicinal herb native to California. It reduces swelling in the brain and could successfully treat Alzheimer's. And as we know, Alzheimer's disease is so frightening because we have not approached it as if lifestyle made a difference. We've approached it as if there's this pathogenic activity, these amyloid plaques being laid down like little white streaks of fat in the brain, and that's disrupting the neurons and synaptic passageways in the brain. And a person then goes into a form of dementia, because Alzheimer's is one form of dementia. But we're approaching it from the other side and saying, what is it that we can use on a daily basis that could help prevent this? And what we're finding is, and it's certainly in the scientific literature, that as long as we're turning off inflammatory cytokines, we're helping prevent dementia and brain damage. And herbs like turmeric that has curcumin and blueberries, which are rich in phytonutrients and antioxidants, there are a lot of different things that can turn off inflammation. Green tea turns off inflammation. But now there's an herb, the Herbasante, which is also known as holy herb in Spanish, and its effects could prove to be a major improvement in reducing swelling in the brain and notably treat Alzheimer's disease. It's long been used by the native populations of California. It's a tea that's brewed using the leaves to address headaches and fevers and respiratory problems. It's also been used as a poultice for sore muscles and wounds and rheumatism. Well, according to the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, they recently revealed the strong neuroprotective and anti-inflammatory properties of the plant in a study that was published in Redox Biology Journal. Just something to add, these are all pieces to puzzles, and each piece that we have we didn't have before takes us one step further helping this. And also, Johns Hopkins scientists have looked at the most common cancer-suppressing compounds. They're in vegetables. Now, we know a couple things. We know we didn't need Johns Hopkins because there's thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed to link compounds found in Brussels sprouts, kale, arugula, mustard greens, radishes, broccoli, and other cruciferous vegetables to the body's most potent tumor-suppressing genes. We also know that it can be up to 100 times more enzymes in bean sprouts than uncooked fruits and vegetables. And enzymes are special types of proteins that act as catalysts for your body's functions. And extracting more vitamins and minerals and amino acids and essential fatty acids from the foods you eat ensures that your body has the nutritional building blocks of life to ensure every process works more effectively. So eating an apple, just having an apple, or eating an onion, or you're getting quercetin. And quercetin is phenomenal for your immune system. It also is, along with vitamin C, helps manufacture new collagen to keep your skin and elastin and collagen tight so you don't get that jowly, drooping skin effect. And we know that sulforaphane is a potent antibiotic, and it's in broccoli sprouts in very high concentrations, and it's terrific. You get more of this in sprouts than you do in the finished head of broccoli. That's why we emphasize the power of sprouts, especially beneficial for osteoarthritis and cancer. Now, sprouts are alkalizing to your body, and we know a lot of illnesses, including cancer, have been linked to excess acidity in the body. Alcohol acidity, sugar acidity, meat acidity, caffeine acidity. So a lot of what we do on a regular basis, even if we're not conscious of it, is we create an over-acid medium in the body. And the growth of cancer cells are initiated by a lack of oxygen, and these cells, along with viruses and bacteria, cannot live easily in an alkaline and oxygen-rich environment. So exercising increases oxygenation of tissues. That's good. And being able to take living foods with juices, like having some green apple juice with lemon and ginger in the morning, that's terrific for your body. And broccoli sprouts are especially effective at preventing gastritis, ulcers, and stomach cancer, and even allergies and asthma. And probably the most powerful compound in all this is what's called I3C. It stands for indole-3-carbinol. And that is involved in a very complex chemical chain reaction that frees the tumor suppressing to do its job. So if you want to prevent cancer, eat more living foods. Eat more cruciferous vegetables. Eat more alkalizing foods like pineapple and papaya, apples, and grapes. And finally, when it comes to talking about health, I continuously see people conflating two issues. Actually, three issues. And the issues are this. That because we have foolishly, and for profit and proprietary control only, had a war on drugs. We should never have had a war on drugs. It was just like prohibition. It was stupid. But it was easy for people in power to benefit if they knew that they had a drug that you had to use for a particular condition. And if you bought their drug, then you wouldn't be able to use, for example, the cannabinoids, the natural oils from marijuana. So they would simply work their wonders behind the scenes to make sure that everybody coming into office got on board with the war on drugs. And then you create a monster that just metastasizes and absorbs the public money and gives you nothing but damaged and dead bodies in whole areas of the world overtaken by narco-terrorists. Look at our efforts in Colombia. Look at San Salvador, Nicaragua, and that's the outcome. But then on the other end of that is we should have long time ago, and we should now, stop the entire war on drug and provide clinics where people can detoxify. But also we should, and it's just my own personal opinion, expunge every single person's record who've ever been convicted for using drugs. And we won't do that, but I'm just saying what we should do if we were an ethical and conscientious society. Isn't it amazing that George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama all bragged in their work about using drugs, and yet they turned around and locked up people for decades for using the same drugs that they got away with? Do you see the hypocrisy here? In any case, we have then tried to say that marijuana is a gateway drug. It is not. Alcohol is, not marijuana. You'll hear the Bill O'Reillys of the world and other people who have a similar diminutive intellect and lack of awareness, but lots of political fervor, try to make that argument. But here's an argument that is legitimate. Let's separate them out. Medical marijuana, especially the oil, which is non-hallucinogenic, there are over 22,000 studies currently and counting in the Library of Medicine. So it's not as if there has not been a lot of really good work on what it will do. It can stop seizures. It can help with brain cancer, lung cancer. It can help with neuropathies. It can help with macular degeneration. It's just one of the most singularly important natural medications we could use in our society can help with autism. Now, so therefore it should be legal and purchasable in every place in the United States. Two, we should let everyone out of jail now and expunge their records and actually help them with some form of career processing to help them get back into society and be reunited with their families, which they deserve. Three, we should also take a look at what happens when you smoke marijuana. And here's where the confusion comes. But as a scientist, as someone who's worked in addiction control for a long time and helped a lot of addicts detoxify and get off their addictive substances, whatever they were, this is the rub. A lot of people say, yeah, it should be legal. I agree. You shouldn't be penalized for using it. I agree. You should be able to use it. I agree. It's good for you. I disagree. Marijuana is not good for you. It's extremely harmful. How so? Well, first, look at the scientific literature. In just one paper I was writing, I used 122 different scientific papers, high-quality research showing what it does. I saw what it did to two of my friends. Two of my best friends were simply unable to function in society because they were chronic users of marijuana. In fact, one ended up living in Hawaii with his son, lived up in the mountains, his son renting a little house up there. I went to see him, and he'd been a friend for 50 years, and he was just gone. Delusional, psychotic, paranoid, and he wouldn't stop. I saw that happen in two people. So there's finally the Canadian Association for Neuroscience did a study. And they wanted to see what happens to young people that are using it. Young people meaning ages 15 to 19. And what it does to the developing brain. Meaning what happens to your things such as maturation of cognitive functions, working memory, decision-making, impulsivity control. And by the way, that's a very vulnerable period for the development of the brain, as it represents a critical period wherein regulatory connections between higher-order regions of the cortex and emotional processing circuits deeper inside the brain are established. So it's a period of strong remodeling, making adolescents highly vulnerable to drug-related developmental disturbances. But we have done none of this in the United States. And as a result, we just think, there's no problem. There is. And what they found was that those that use cannabis, smoke marijuana, had substantial problems in all these areas. They had problems that they used alcohol. They used problem had same problems they have cannabis. Cognitive function and was disturbed. Cognitive testing was substantially altered. And impulsivity, working memory, inhibitory control. Mind you, inhibitory control is what's necessary for you as a parent or a guardian be able to help someone realize, have some self-control. You can't just act out of impulse on what bothers you. Even if what bothers you may be legitimate, you can't just do what you want to do in any given moment because there's always going to be a consequence. Think before you do something. There has to be what we call cognitive perceptual reasoning. And we found that cannabis use was also linked to deficits in memory recall and perceptual reasoning. Hence, a person was far less likely, if they smoked marijuana, to have any of these controls. Now, think about what happens when you impact the brain at a young age, and you do it so frequently that you alter it permanently. Yeah. and teams of scientists have demonstrated that adolescent exposure to THC induces changes in specific areas of the brain called the prefrontal cortex and in a brain circuit and mesolimbic pathways that closely resemble the abnormalities observed in schizophrenia. So if your son or daughter is regularly smoking marijuana and you see that they're having problems processing memory and regulating anxiety or having trouble with social interactions, it may not be just a perceptual issue or personality trait. It may be that that is what the marijuana is doing. And that's the conflation, because for so long, people thought, no one's going to go rob a bank from smoking marijuana. I agree. But look at what it does when people are aligned with it constantly and having close friends that had that problem and seeing that it was a challenging journey. In fact, one of the one of my best friends for decades and decades, he's just passed, and his son contacted me 25 years ago and said, Dad's just out of control, can you come and help? So I flew out to California, and I intervened the next day, and he was completely off the walls, paranoia. They're out to get me, and when I tried to sit down and said, this is the impact of the gold glucose poisoning and the marijuana on your brain. No, you don't understand. And his sons are there. And he wouldn't change. And that's when they finally took him. I said, bring him to my home. I'll work with him. He wouldn't come. And instead, they took him to Hawaii, and they couldn't have him relate in their own worlds, because both are people that can't watch someone 24/7. And boy, when you got someone that's this loose, and another friend, very, very close friend, hadn't heard from a long time, and I called, where's this person at? They're up in New Paltz. Have you heard from him? Haven't heard a word. Something's wrong then. So he drove up, got to the house. The car was sitting outside, knocked on the door, no answer. And I said, there's something terribly wrong here. Well, they're not home. They must be okay. I said, no, they're not. They're home and they're not okay. So I went around and I broke a window and I opened, went inside, and the other person was just strung out on the floor. And the dog was almost dead. It was just bones, hadn't been fed. So I worked on both the dog and the person and got them back. I brought them both down to my home and worked on them. It took 3 months just to get them normalized. And you have no idea what it's like until you've dealt with drug addiction to see what people will go through in withdrawal and how you're frequently dealing with someone that you will not recognize. So for someone who says, oh, it's all innocent, it isn't. That's stupidity. And I wish people would, before they make some stupid statement, would actually review the scientific literature, or if they've unfortunately had the experiences many of us have had, understand there's a difference between having a chemical substance in something that can be used safely in the body that will do what no medicine could do, good, versus smoking the damn stuff, where you end up with carcinogenic factors far exceeding cigarettes, and they've conflated the issues all as one. It's good, it's great, no problem. Medicinally, it is good in its right form. It should not be illegal, and nobody should be punished for using it. But you go smoking it, boy, are you making a mistake. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're 40 minutes into our program. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to go to this one clip that discusses with white, liberal, wealthy students at University of California, Berkeley. They did another one at Stanford University, by the way. I've seen two. And they had very strong opinions about blacks and their inability to be able to vote. And then they went to Harlem and spoke with blacks about their ability to vote. Listen to this. This is just one little tiny eye-opening reality check.
I'm Ami Horowitz, and I'm here in Berkeley, California, to find out if voter ID laws suppress the black vote. Do you have an opinion on voter ID laws?
Yeah, they're usually pretty racist, and they're bad.
I think voter ID laws are a way to perpetuate racism.
Would you go as far as say they're, those laws are racist?
For sure.
Do you think it suppresses the African-American vote?
Definitely.
Because
they're less likely to have state IDs.
Minority voters are less likely to have the kinds of IDs that have been described or required.
These type of people don't live in areas with easy access to DMVs or other places where they can get identification.
You can always get IDs over the internet. Does that also make it difficult for black people in particular?
Yeah, you have to have access to the internet. You have to be able to pay an internet service provider for certain fees.
Do you think that's harder for black people to go online?
Well, I feel like they don't have the knowledge of how it works.
A lot of people have smartphones, but you might not have data.
For most of the communities, they don't really know what is out there just because they're not aware or
right.
They're not informed. I also think there's a repression of black voting with how if you're a convicted felon, you're not allowed to vote and everything. And when you look at swing states like Florida, that's a huge population of the African Americans.
Now I'm here in East Harlem to ask black people their thoughts on what you just heard. Do you have ID normally? You carry ID around?
Yes, I have state ID.
Do you carry ID?
Yes, I do.
Do you know anybody any black person who doesn't carry ID?
No. Everyone that I know has an ID. Why would they think we don't have ID?
That's a lie. Why would they say that?
Do you have ID?
Yes.
Because I have my ID and my friends have their ID, so we know what we need to carry around.
Everybody that I know have ID. That's one of the things you need to walk around with New York with, ID.
Do you know any black adult who does not have ID?
No, I don't.
Is it a weird thing to even say that?
Yes, it is.
What is this, some type of trick candy camera?
I know,
like that?
Right? That's the only thing I brought with me.
Those are legit IDs. I heard a lot also that black people can't figure out how to get to the DMV.
Really?
What does that say to you?
I know where that is, on 25th Street.
Do you know where the ID, the DMV is around you?
It's on 125th Street and 3rd Avenue, I believe.
You know how to get there?
Yeah.
Do you have a problem getting there if you have to get there?
No.
I know these sound like silly questions. You know how to get the DMV?
Of course.
You know where it is?
Yes.
You can get there?
Uh-huh.
No problem.
No problem.
Just checking.
Okay.
And I also heard a lot that black people, especially poor black people, have no access to the internet, can't figure out how to use the internet.
That's just stupidity, honestly. Everybody has access to the internet. Even a little kid can figure out how to work the internet.
I had access to the internet for years.
You know how to use it properly, right?
Exactly. I do it at work. So, of course, I know how to use it. Smart. My kids know how to use it. They all have iPads, iPods, whatever.
Your phone has data?
Mm-hmm.
You can access the internet.
Unlimited.
Unlimited data.
Mm-hmm.
I use my phone as a hotspot.
What does that say to you for the people who have this perception of black people?
They're pretty much ignorant. That's why my thought process on it.
I just think that's ignorant.
Ignorant.
Ignorant. That's the
very,
word I hear
very
a lot.
Ignorant.
Ignorant.
Very, very ignorant.
Does it sound racist for somebody to say that?
I think it is a little racist because, you know, you're putting people in a category and you have no idea what you're talking about.
Maybe a little bit of racist in it, but like I said, I think it's more stupidity and ignorance.
You're judging somebody, you're judging them because they're black, saying that they don't got it.
What people are they talking to? Who are these people talking to?
Do you have a problem that if you go to vote and they say, can we please see your ID to make sure you are who you say you are?
Love showing my ID.
You had no problem with that?
Nope.
Would you have a problem if when you go to vote, if they say, can we please just see your ID to make sure you are who you say you are? Do you have an issue with that?
No.
Would you have a problem if there was a rule where you have to show your ID in order to vote?
I don't think so. No.
Would you have an issue if there was a rule saying you got to show your ID before you vote?
No.
Are you cool with that?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the issue. Two groups of people. Clearly, one group is not aware of an awful lot about the understanding, educational level, street awareness, the ability to thrive on all levels, intellectually, creatively. within a society that has historically and does today a lot of elements of racist overtones, even a lot that is not obvious. What does it say when there is such a disconnect, and how many other disconnects are there? If you're coming from a place that because of your position, because of your wealth, because of your social class, that you're considered to be more entitled, or that somehow you are able to make judgments about other people without fully knowing them. It says a lot. And unfortunately, that is a divide that has not yet been fully understood. But remember, there's going to be a group of people every day entering the workforce or already in the workforce that are entering the positions of policymakers and opinion leaders, and they're taking all of their limitations and understandings, their strengths and weaknesses, into the decisions that they make. And that's unfortunate. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Null. I'm going to try to share one thing with you, because this is for this is for all the young people who are graduating now. These coming years are going to be challenging for so many people. If your mother or father are one of the 70 million professional class lawyers, doctors, engineers, economists, scientists, professors, people tenured, people protected, people who can live within their means, and their means are substantive, then you're going to have a safety net that others will not have. For everyone else, you may not have any safety net. You may not have someone who can open a door for you. And a lot of graduates now will find themselves overtaxed, burdened with excessive college debt, and struggling to find worthwhile employment in a debt-ridden economy on the brink of implosion. Their privacy will be eviscerated by the surveillance state. They will be the subjects of a military empire constantly waging war against shadowy enemies, and government agents armed to the teeth, ready and able to lock down the country at a moment's notice. As such, they will find themselves forced to march in lockstep with a government that no longer exists to serve the people, but which demands that they be obedient slaves or suffer the consequences. It may seem dismal, it is not hopeless. Unfortunately, we who should have known better failed to guard against such a future. Worse, we neglected to maintain our freedoms or provide our young people with the tools necessary to survive, let alone succeed in the impersonal jungle that is modern America. We didn't say a word when artificial intelligence, transhumanism, automation in the workplace, and visas from countries bringing in a PhD who is willing to work for $40,000 a year and take the place of a person who's worked there for 30 years making $180,000. We didn't find that important. Now it is. We brought them into homes fractured by divorce, distracted by mindless entertainment, and obsessed with the pursuit of materialism. We institutionalized them in daycares and after-school programs, substituting time with teachers and child care workers for parental involvement. We turned them into test takers instead of thinkers, and automatons instead of activists. We allowed them to languish in schools which not only look like prisons, but function like prisons as well, where conformity is the rule and freedom is the exception. We made them easy prey for our corporate overlords while instilling in them the values of a celebrity-obsessed, technologically-driven culture devoid of any true spirituality. And we taught them to believe that the pursuit of their own personal happiness trumped all other virtues, including any empathy whatsoever for their fellow human beings. No, we haven't done this generation any favors. Based on the current political climate, things could very well get much worse before they ever take a turn for the better. But I want to share some optimism in the face of such critical times. First, be an individual. For all of its claims to champion the individual, America culture advocates a stark conformity, which, as John F. Kennedy warned, is the tailor of freedom and the enemy of growth. Worry less about fitting in with the rest of the world, and instead, as Henry David Thoreau urged, become that person who seeks the truth. Open new channels. Learn your rights. We're losing our freedoms for one simple reason. Most of us don't know anything about our freedoms. At a minimum, anyone who has graduated from high school, let alone college, should know the Bill of Rights backwards and forwards. Speak truth to power. Don't be naive about those in positions of authority. As James Madison, who wrote our Bill of Rights, observed, all men have power ought to be distrusted. I repeat that. All men having power ought to be distrusted. We must learn the lessons of history. People in power more often than not abuse that power. To maintain our freedoms, this will mean challenging government officials whenever they exceed the bounds of their office, or those in the media who exceed the bounds of common sense and reason. Resist all things that numb you. Don't measure your worth by what you own or earn. Likewise, don't become mindless consumers unaware of the world around you. Resist all things that numb you, put you to sleep, or help you cope with so-called reality. Those who establish the rules and laws that govern society's actions desire compliant subjects. However, as George Orwell warned us, until they become conscious, they will never rebel, and until they rebelled, they cannot become conscious. It is these conscious individuals who challenge the world for the better. Don't let technology turn you into zombies. Technology anesthetizes us to all too real tragedies that surround us. Techno-gadgets are merely distractions from what's really going on in America and around the world. As a result, we become mimicking the inhuman technology that surrounds us and have lost our humanity. Help others. We all have a calling in life, and I believe it boils down to one thing. You're here on this planet to help others. In fact, none of us can exist very long without the help from others. If we're going to see any positive change for freedom, then we must change our view of what it means to be a human and regain our sense of purpose, of what it means to love and help one another. That will mean gaining the courage to stand up for the oppressed. Give voice to moral outrage. As Martin Luther King said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter. There's no shortage of issues on which to take a stand. For example, on any given night, over 500,000 people in the United States are homeless, and half of them are elderly. There are 46 million Americans living at or below the poverty line, 16 million children living in households without adequate food. Congress, however, found a way to create 50 new criminal laws each year, with more than 2 million Americans in prison, close to 7 million adults in correctional care in the United States. The United States has the largest prison population in the world, and at least 2.7 million children in the United States have at least one parent in prison. This is absurd. Cultivate spirituality, reject materialism, and put people first. When the things that matter most have been subordinated to materialism, we have lost our moral compass. We must change our values to reflect something more meaningful than technology, materialism, and politics. Standing at the pulpit at the Riverside Church in New York City on April 1967, Martin Luther King urged his listeners, "We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit, motive, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Pitch in and do your part to make the world a better place. Don't rely on someone else to do the heavy lifting for you. Don't wait around for someone else to fix what ails you, your community or a nation. As Gandhi urged, be the change you wish to see in the world. Say no to war. So address those who are pro-war, which is virtually the entirety of the Democratic Republican parties with few exceptions. Have the courage to say no, not a dollar more for corrupt wars and interventions. Put that money back into our society to see that the people come first. From our infrastructures to our public schools, forgive student debt, pass universal health care. It will make a difference for the youth of the futures to have a future. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. My darling.